Hello, everyone. I hope you can all hear me now. Thank you so much for being here on a Saturday. I have to apologize. I have a bit of a cold, so hopefully it won't be too annoying to hear my voice. So thank you so much for being here. This is our second Conversation on Buddha Nature event in the new year. Unfortunately, already there's been so much sad news. I hope this event will be a bright part of the day. You can see all the past events on the Buddha Nature Resource website. They're now available both as video and audio recordings that you can download and play anytime. So please feel free to send questions with the Q&A function on Zoom, or if you're live on Facebook, just use the comments there. I'll take a look. We'll have time set aside for questions at the end. So Conversations on Buddha Nature is a series of online interviews with Buddhist practitioners, scholars, and thinkers on the topic of Buddha Nature. For this event, Lopan Dr. Karmapunso will speak with the master translator and Buddhist teacher, Dr. Carl Brunhosel. So we're honored to have Mitra Carl with us here today. I studied with Carl at Natarta Institute, where he has translated, taught, and developed much of the curriculum for over 20 years. Carl is one of the most prolific translators of Tibetan texts into English and has worked on all of the five treatises of Maitreya and has published more than 20 books now, I think, many of which are extensive and have many different Tibetan texts translated in each one. We actually have an ongoing tally at Sadra Foundation's research department. And currently, of all books on Buddhism we have in our library, Carl holds the record for the most footnotes, as well as the longest footnote. But not all of his books are scholarly in nature. Actually, much of his work is focused on practice and practical instruction. He was originally trained as a physician and then studied at Kamala Shila Institute, Kempo Tsochum Gyamso's Marpa Institute, and Hamburg University. And since 1989, Carl has served as a translator, interpreter, and Buddhist teacher mainly in Europe, India, and Nepal. Carl's current projects include translating the largest compendium of the foundational texts of Mahamudra compiled by the Seventh Karmapa called Sounds of Innate Freedom, the Indian text of Mahamudra, which is coming out in installments from Wisdom Publications. So Carl's book, When the Clouds Part, the Uttara Tantra and its meditative tradition as a bridge between Sutra and Tantra, was the foundation of our Buddha Nature Resource website. And he was one of the first people that we interviewed for this project. So once again, thank you so much for being here with us today. As you all know, Lopan Dr. Karmapunso is the recipient of Sadra Foundation's Writer in Digital Residence Grant for Buddha Nature Studies and is our host for these conversations on Buddha Nature. Karmapunso is one of Bhutan's leading intellectuals and completed both monastic training in the Tibetan traditions, as well as a doctorate at Oxford. He is the founder of the Lodin Foundation in Bhutan, and his work is well known across the Himalayas and in Buddhist studies circles around the world. So without further ado, please welcome Carl Brunhosel joining us from Munich, Germany, and Karmapunso joining us from Bhutan.
Thank you, Marcus. And hello, Tashidele, Kuzo Zangbo. Good morning, afternoon, evening, wherever you are. And welcome, Carl. A really great honor to have you with us. You have been with us during the launch of this event, and it's nice to see you again. Before we start the session, let's give a few moments to cultivate the right intention and make prayers and wishes that this benefit all sentient beings, especially as we are gripped with news of aggression in Ukraine and many other parts of the world. Let's hope that this message of Buddha Nature, combining wisdom and compassion, reaches more hearts. Thank you. And Carl, once again, it's a great honor for us to have you. And I hope my internet connection will stay stable. It's been quite erratic these days, and there has also been power cuts. So I hope I'll be able to stay with you until the end of the conversation. Yes. Now you have been such a great authority on Buddha nature, especially in English. And as I've been working on Buddha nature for Satra Foundation, I've discovered that you have done so much. One point I was thinking of collating and compiling the commentaries on the crucial verses from the Ultimate Continuum by Maitreya. Yeah. And I discovered you have already done that. And I was also thinking about some sort of precursors to the Shentongpa thought in Tibet. And I discovered you have again done that. So I've been discovering quite a lot of wonderful work that you have done. And it's really wonderful to have you in this forum again. And through this forum, as you know, we are trying to create a space for people to share experiences and insights into Buddha nature. For beginners, we hope that we can promote this message of Buddha nature and through this an ethos of positive thinking, the innate goodness of all beings. And then for more advanced students and practitioners, hope that this sharing of experiences and insights can deepen their understanding of Buddha nature and their familiarity with it. So wonderful to have you, given your long sort of experience in studying, researching, teaching topics related to Buddha nature. I often ask my guests the first question of when and how did you encounter the teachings on Buddha nature and what you thought about it?
Yeah, thank you, Kamala. It's a great honor for me to be here as well. And, you know, there's so many people now who are working on Buddha nature teachings. So, you know, it's great to see that. I'm sure the one who is behind all that is nobody else but Buddha nature, you know, the flourishing of the teachings. So that's great. And I make the aspiration that whatever good comes from this session that we're having today will be hopefully a small cause for stopping the aggression in the world and in particular in the Ukraine. So to your question, I think my first encounter with Buddha nature, you know, in terms of teaching was a little bit in disguise, which is fitting for Buddha nature and ordinary sentient beings. Because it was through Shambhala training. And in its very, very early days in 1983 and 1984 in Marburg in Germany. So there was just under development, the Shambhala training. Of course, now it's a big thing. So at that point, there were 5 training levels. And so I went through them and each was a weekend and they talked about basic goodness, which if one knows Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings, that is his non-Buddhist term for Buddha nature, basically. So that was what I was exposed to first. And it was very nice because it was, the teachers were very good. They were very heartfelt, like they really put themselves out there. So it was really like a, you know, embodiment, open heart of Buddha nature. So that left quite an impression in me. And then, of course, later I encountered the more formal teachings, Buddhist teachings, first in the Dual Ornament and then in the Uttara Tantra. So, yeah, but that was hitting the heart. That was the first thing. Mm.
Who did you receive those teachings, initial teachings on Uttara Tantra, the ultimate continuum from?
The Uttara Tantra was actually in Kamala Shila Institute in the course of a 5-year training in Buddhist studies from a Kaji Kempo. And so he was living in France at the time. He is no longer alive. So that was, yeah, it was that.
And you have now produced your magnum opus, such a wonderful work, Locus Classicus, I think, for studying the Uttara Tantra, or the ultimate continuum in English, When Clouds Part, the Uttara Tantra and its meditative tradition as a bridge between Sutra and Tantra. What inspired you to write this volume? It's such a sort of large work, impressive, covering quite a lot of detail.
Yeah, I mean, most people won't believe that, but the original scope of the book was actually very modest. Like, basically just translate the Uttara Tantra, the commentary that Tibetan tradition ascribes to Asanga, Ratnagotra Vibhaga Vyakya, and then one Tibetan commentary by Tashi Ösa. And so, and mainly why I wanted to do that is because I thought the available English translations of the Uttara Tantra and its commentary were a little bit outdated. Like Obermiller had done one and Takasaki. And of course, they were great pioneers, but I felt I would take my own step at it. But then when I started working on this, then more and more things kept popping up, and that's how the book mushroomed into its present form. So for example, Sean Price from Tsardar Foundation, actually, he alerted me at some point. He said, did you know there's a commentary by Marpa Lotsawa on the Uttara Tantra? And I said, no, I had no idea. No, I never heard about that. And then, so he sent me photocopies of that. And then I think that's one of your other questions for later, who that commentary is by. Anyway, that popped up, and then a lot of texts in the Kadampa tradition, mostly by Gyoden Mönlam Tsultrim, that also are like more experiential instructions on the Uttara Tantra. Those came up, and then I did take another look at the Eight Kamapas, Lamp of Shentong, and also Chamdong Tungtul's guiding instructions. And I was also interested in the connection between Mahamudra and the Uttara Tantra, and then also the meditative tradition of the Maitreya text. I heard that word many times, but I never had really any idea, okay, what is that exactly, and is there any sources? So I know that, and then also there was some interest in the sutra sources of Buddha nature. So all of that then came together. So it was much bigger than originally intended.
And your subtitle of this book explicitly mentions how the Uttara Tantra or Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the ultimate continuum, is a bridge between Sutra and Tantra. And that's often been said about this particular text. Although we know it is a sort of a Sutra-based Shastra, a Sutra-based treatise. In what ways would you argue is this a bridge between Sutra and Tantra? And where does this idea come from?
Well, I'm not sure who brought it up first, but I know that it is definitely verbalized as such in the Kamakaji curriculum of the so-called eight great texts, five of which are considered the more or less classical Sutra texts that pretty much everybody studies, like, you know, Pramanavartika and commentaries and Abhisamayalamkara and Madhyamakavatara and the Vinaya and so on. And but then there's three additional texts which are classified as Tantra, and the first one of those is the Uttara Tantra, and that is explicitly said that this is the bridge between Sutra and Tantra. And then the other two is the Profound Inner Topics by the Third Kamapa and the Hevata Tantra. So those are considered to be in one group, in addition to the classical sutra topics. And then I would say that the Uttara Tantra provides the basic view of Buddha nature. It doesn't really talk about practice, obviously, like really not at all. But it is definitely in the Kamakaji tradition, it is said to be the view, the basic view of all tantras. Because all the tantras speak about a disclosure model of the nature of the mind, Buddha nature, however you want to call it, but they're not necessarily giving a systematic presentation of Buddha nature in the way that the Uttara Tantra does. But they're kind of presupposing that kind of understanding. So you could say the Uttara Tantra is the view that's also present in the tantras, whereas then the tantras are the actually, how do you practice with that view? Like, how do you directly work with Buddha nature? Because the Vajrayana obviously is, it's also called the resultant vehicle, right? Resultant jhana, as opposed to the causal one. So what is the resultant? And that's also clearly outlined in the Uttara Tantra, that basically the ground, or the fourth Vajra point, which is the Dhatu, Buddha nature itself, is really not different from the fruition. So what you're working with in the Vajrayana is exactly that. And so otherwise, I think you could not call the Vajrayana resultant jhana. Because if you understand Buddha nature is just a seed or a potential, that's not the fruition. Nobody says that, right? So if Vajrayana would work only with seed or potential, then it would still be causal jhana. So I think that's a important point, that when you talk about resultant jhana, what does that mean? It really means you try to work with the fruition as much as possible. And that's only possible in terms of Buddha nature, since the cause and the result are not different. So in that way, then you could say the Uttara Tantra is the bridge.
So in considering the Uttara Tantra as a bridge between Sutra and Tantra, we're basically implying that Buddha nature is identical with the resultant state of the Buddhahood.
Well, that's what it says, is my understanding in the Uttara Tantra, very clearly. Like, it talks about suchness with stains, and it talks about suchness without stains, right? Fourth Vajra point is with stains. Fifth Vajra point and all after that is without stains. But the suchness is the same. But of course, I know there's many debates on that and different opinions.
Yes, indeed, yes. But I was also wondering if, in addition to the actual topics covered by the text, even the title itself, unlike all the other sutra treatises, not having an explicit term tantra as part of the title, if this has also led to people think that this is already sort of a step moving away from sutra towards a tantragram.
Yes, definitely, because some people actually do interpret the word tantra and Uttara Tantra as referring to the causal tantra, the method tantra, and the fruitional tantra. But that's not everybody. Some people do that. So they explicitly link it to the to that kind of language, which is exclusive to the Vajrayana. So yeah, clearly that is there. Though the text itself explains it differently.
And then when you talk about the Buddha nature teachings in the Kagyu tradition, which is our focus today, in general Tibetan scholarship or in general Tibetan sort of historical transmissions, you have the scholarly transmission through Ngok Lotsawa and his followers, and then the meditative transmission through Zen Kaoche and his followers. But in addition to these two, would you say that the Kagyupas actually received also a transmission via Maitripa and Marpa directly? So not necessarily channeled through Sajjana in Kashmir and through Kashmir.
Well, that is possible, but I haven't seen any explicit record of such a distinct separate tradition. And it seems, I mean, it could of course be that, you know, the whole thing went just orally and was kept secret. That is very much possible. But it seems that Marpa clearly was focused on tantras and Vajrayana. Like, from all we know, he didn't do really much sutra studies, if any. And also the early Kagyu masters mostly were yogis and mostly oriented in that. Gampopa was one exception in his early life, and he studied with the Kadampa, and I think that's probably where the early Kagyu masters got their sutra studies. I mean, in the case of Gampopa, it's very clear, but also the other early Kagyu figures, like the first Karmapa and also the early other Karmapas and others, they all had studied with Kadampas or Sakyas. And so since we now know that there is this transmission of the Uttara Tantra meditative tradition actually in the Kadampa school, not necessarily as its mainstream body, but it's there and the texts are still there, then I think that is probably where they received the transmission of both Ngoglo Tsaba's tradition, which was also continued in the Kadampa, and Zen Kabuchi's. And there may have been others, but Zen Kabuchi's lineage is getting a little bit vague after a time in Tibet. And I think they got both from mostly that direction. There's no clear lineage histories about that, like the five treatises transmission in the early Kagyu lineage. It's more of starting with the third Karmapa then, who studied with the abbot of Sangpu, and that's where he got his trainings in the five Maitreya texts in particular. A little bit ahead, but like when you look at Jamin Kongtrul, he received his transmission from the ninth Situ Rinpoche, and he from the 13th Karmapa, and then the eighth Situ Rinpoche, and he got it from Gatok Tsewang Norbu, who they were close friends, ninth Situ Rinpoche and Gatok Tsewang Norbu. So that was coming actually from the Nyingma tradition, and it is said that Gatok Tsewang Norbu told the Eighth Situ Bai he should uphold the Shentong view. And so before that, Jamin Kongtrul lists a whole, mainly the transmission through the Jonang lineage. So that seems to be his main, and he also is his main support is Jonang Taranata. So of course, Buddha nature teachings are, they are very strong.
I think, now, especially in the later chapters of Buddha nature teachings, we seem to have transmissions from so many different sources. I think when we talk about the two main lineages coming from Kashmir, we are mostly talking about the lineage of the Uttara Tantra teachings and not so much all Buddha nature, isn't it? Because later, I mean, when we have Kalachakra come to Tibet, then there's a lot of Buddha nature teachings or teachings on luminosity coming through Kalachakra. And I think Marpa would have received quite a lot of teachings on luminosity and Buddha nature related topics from Naropa and so forth. But to go back to something that you mentioned earlier, now that you said John Price mentioned about a commentary by Marpa Lotsawa, which stimulated you to work further and expand your book. And then you have basically concluded that this commentary is not by Marpa Chöki Lodre, the founding figure of Marpa Kagyu, but rather Marpa Dopa Chöki Wangchuk. Can you tell us a bit more on how you reached this conclusion?
Yeah, it seems that the commentary is actually by a student, probably, of Marpa Dopa Chöki Wangchuk, because it says in the colophon that it is based on the teachings by Marpa Dopa and also the teachings of the Indian scholar Parahita Bhadra, who also lived in Kashmir. So he was in the same circle, or like Sajana, who taught Ngoglo Tsaba and also Zen Kabuchi. And so the first thing that, of course, I noticed was when I heard about this commentary being by Marpa Lotsawa, the famous Marpa Lotsawa, because Marpa Dopa was also Lotsawa. And finally, the two actually met, according to Blue Annals, on the way to Tibet, to India and Tibet, crossing each other's paths. And so, but I had never heard of anybody say in the Kadyu tradition that there was a commentary on the Uttara Tantra by Marpa Lutsava. And still, nobody says that. So if there had been such a commentary, or even like, you know, the assumption, that would have been definitely a big enough thing to make a big deal out of it. But there is no such thing. And then there's also, since the colophon of the commentary clearly says that it is based on Parahita Bhadra's teaching, then there's no evidence that Marpa Chikilodri was in Kashmir or had any contact with Parahita Bhadra or Sajana at all. Like, actually, he was mostly in East India. And so these are the explicit sources in the commentary that are mentioned in the colophon. And then the other thing is that, of course, Marpa's dates are still not definitely settled, but if you take about something like, you know, 1012 to 1097, which a lot of people seem to agree on, then Ngoklo Tsaba was 1059 to 1109, which means quite a bit later. But the commentary refers to Ngoklo Tsaba's translation, actually, so which means it was made later than Ngoklo Tsaba's translation. So it would have been very, very difficult in terms of just timing for Marpa Chökyalodri to have written that, because either he was already dead when Ngoklo Tsaba made his translation, or of very old age in Tibet somewhere. So that's another thing. And then when you look at Marpa Lutsava's translations, they're pretty much all tantric. There is no sutra-based translation. So given all that, and that there is a clear historical connection between Parahita Bhadra and Marpa Dopa, then it seemed pretty clear to me that it's not by Marpa Chökyalodri. And Marpa Dopa is an interesting figure because he was actually quite a major translator. He translated a lot of Chakrasamvara related text and taught those in Tibet widely. And he had met Naropa also, like the other Marpa, and studied with all the Indian students of Naropa. So he shares basically the same background in terms of transmission.
Okay. Well, I found this commentary in the collections of Marpa Chökyalodri. So some people still think that it is by Marpa. Now, coming to the main sort of exponent, let's say, the first main exponent of Buddha nature theories from the Karmakaji tradition would be Third Karmapa, who you brought up earlier. A lot of people think that Third Karmapa is a Shen Tongpa, somebody who argued for the other emptiness, Buddha nature being empty of vicious stains and not being empty of itself. But then Karmapa Rangjung Dorje also actually expounded something which combines both emptiness and luminosity, isn't it? He didn't espouse the same kind of Shentong as Dolpopa, for instance. So can you shed more light on that? You have done a lot of work on Rangjung Dorje.
Yeah, I think it's pretty striking that, I mean, first of all, the word Shentong appears in no writing of Rangjung Dorje that we know of. And there is this story about that he met Dolpopa and so on and so forth. And so, of course, you can classify the third Karmapa as Shentong if you want, but it has to be clear that there's many different types of Shentong. So if you classify a third Karmapa, as you say, as Shentong, it should be very clear that he's not saying the same things as Dolpopa. But he clearly also subscribes to the disclosure model of Buddha nature, which means the qualities are there, they just need to be revealed. There's no actual new development of previously not existing qualities. And he also says clearly that Buddha nature is not just mere emptiness. But in his presentation, he very skillfully combines actually the teachings on Buddha nature, Yogacara, and Madhyamaka. Also in terms of his quotes and the whole way he presents it. So he also says Buddha nature is basically non-dual, non-conceptual wisdom, which is free of adventitious stains, which of course a classical Shantung presentation. He also says it's natural luminosity, all these things, not empty of its own wisdom nature. But then also he says very clearly that this cannot be pinpointed as being empty, not being empty, both or neither, which is very classical Madhyamika. And so one of the crucial things he also says that has become a hallmark of Kaji, also in Mahamudra, is the difference between samsara and nirvana is whether the nature of the mind, meaning Buddha nature, is realized or not. In other words, is recognized for what it is or not, which then was later attacked by Dalpopa. But then he also, that Kamapa also goes, subscribes to the Yogacara model of the eight consciousnesses then becoming the four wisdoms of a Buddha and all that. And he says that in the final picture, all the great Indian masters, whether they're Yogacara or Madhyamika, they agree on this point as the correct view of all the jhanas. In Kamakaji, at least, Third Kamapa is definitely seen as the ultimate authority on Buddha nature. And I think pretty much everybody after him more or less followed this. Like Third Kamapa hasn't spelled out maybe all the details that then somebody like the Eighth Kamapa or Chamin Kongtrul did later, but he definitely gave the general picture. So you could say, if you want to call him Shantung, then it's a very balanced form of Shantung. Like, as some people call it, non-exclusivist Shantung.
Non-absolutist, can you say that as well? Because he proposes a union of emptiness and luminosity to describe Buddha nature, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's all to that point that, you know, yes, the qualities of Buddha nature are there, but if there's even the slightest iota of reification or clinging or solidification, then that's not it. So that element is very clear.
And so then we find the eighth Karmapa also discussing Buddha nature and theorizing Buddha nature. But in between, who would be some of the most important Karmakaji proponents of Buddha nature theory?
Well, we know that there's a commentary by Kama Kencho Shenu, which, as far as I know, is not available. It is listed in some catalog of texts in the, I think, Drepung monastery, but it's not available. So he was a student of the fourth Kamapa. And then, of course, there's Gyelo Tsaba, whose commentary we have. And that is definitely, in my opinion, that is the most unique and most interesting commentary on the Uttara Tantra in the Kaji lineage, if not beyond, because he links the Uttara Tantra to Mahamudra in many ways, in many general ways and also in specific ways. And then there's the seventh Kamapa, who talks also in the line of the third Kamapa about a more moderate Shantung teachings, for example, in his commentary on the Pramana. There's sections where he talks about that. And also in his fragmentary commentary on the Abhisamayalankara, there's also some pieces in there. And then, of course, there's the first and second Kama Trinlipa. First Kama Trinlipa is a student of seventh Kamapa and follows his view, especially in his commentary on the third Kamapa's profound inner topic, Sabonangden. Talks a lot about Buddha nature there and quotes the seventh Kamapa on that topic also. And then there's the second Kama Trinlipa, who wrote a text that actually served as the model for Chamin Kongtrul's Treasure of Knowledge. So it's called the Illuminating the Intention of the Kamapa. So it's like a, you could say it's like a earliest systematic treatise of, you know, kamikaze positions on things, like an encyclopedia kind of thing. Yeah, then there's the eighth karmapa.
Yeah, so when we reach the eighth karmapa, again, we see a major exponent of Buddha nature theory in the Karmakaji tradition. And a lot of people, in fact, even to me, he seemed to present a Buddha nature theory that is not fully aligned to the third karmapa's position almost. You know? Like if you read his commentary on entering the middle way by Chandrakirti, and Chandrakirti being being somebody who expounded emptiness as the ultimate end, regarded Buddha nature sutras also as expedient provisional teachings and not to be taken as definitive teachings. Mikyo Dorje, the eighth karmapa, seemed to sort of take that more strongly in his writings on both Madhyamaka and also the Perfection of Wisdom treatise, Abhisamaya Alankara. And I've read how you try to bring the two together, and I think the eighth karmapa himself also has reinterpreted the third karmapa to sort of bring their positions in alignment. But do you find any tensions between the two in terms of Buddha nature understanding?
I think the eighth karmapa's texts, they say sometimes quite different things about Buddha nature. That's what makes it difficult. Also at different periods. Like, for example, one of his earliest texts was the lamp that illuminates or elucidates Shantong, which is basically a commentary on the fourth Vajra point. And also one of his earliest commentaries was his commentary on the Abhisamayalankara, which also talks about Buddha nature extensively. And it is said in Pabasukla Trangma's history that the early teachers of the eighth karmapa told him he should uphold the Shantong view. So these early texts seem to be more along that line. But when you look at the, as I said, when you look at the commentary on the Abhisamayalankara, he does talk about Buddha nature a lot, also in connection with Mahamudra. But a lot of the way he does is what I call Shantong light, which is, so in the Kaji tradition, they call Salva Shantong and Ying Shantong. So you could say luminosity Shantong and expanse or Datu Shantong. So he's definitely in that commentary on the Ying Shantong side. So sometimes when he talks about Buddha nature in terms of Shantong, it sounds really more like Rangtong. It's actually very interesting to read. And it's almost like, you know, it's really kind of blowing your mind. But then in other texts later, he says more, you could say, things that are in line with the third karmapa and more in line with Salva Shantong. But it's scattered throughout his writings. And then, of course, in the end, and his commentary on the Madhyamakavatara was his last work. And of course, it's not about Buddha nature. So I think that's the main reason why he doesn't really talk about Buddha nature there. But there's an excellent work by Martina Drastic and David Higgins in the Vienna series that's called Buddha Nature Reconsidered. So they basically went through pretty much all of the texts of the eighth karmapa and checked out, okay, what does he say about Buddha nature? And it's very interesting because their result is, which I agree with, that the karmapa's own approach is a middle between the polarized positions of Shantong and Rangtong. Like he tries to harmonize those in a way that combines the virtues of each approach while trying to avoid the pitfalls of each one. So like take the best of each and present that as the highest view while making sure that one doesn't fall into the potential pitfalls that each one may have. And also that book contains a very interesting short list of 16 points that summarize the view of the eighth Karmapa on Buddha nature. And then the two volumes, they spell that out. So that's very helpful, actually. And when you look at these 16 points, then you can see that it agrees actually very much with the third Karmapa. But for the details, I refer to that work, excellent work.
Thank you. Yeah, what I found striking in your analysis is that you say the eighth Karmapa would rather take a sort of a, or suggest a stance where we don't look at Buddha nature from the sentient being's perspective, but rather look at Buddha nature from the Buddha's or the Buddha nature's perspective. So in that respect, sentient beings don't have Buddha nature because sentient beings don't really exist in reality. Can you elaborate a little on that?
Yeah, to me, that was one of the most kind of shocking but also illuminating things that I read from him, because he puts the whole thing, like he turns it upside down. Because like we always hear that sentient beings have Buddha nature. And in his commentary on the Abhisamayalamkara, he makes a very long argument that sentient beings neither are Buddha nature nor have Buddha nature. So it's like the Yerpa and Yinpa thing. So he denies both. And he basically says it's actually the opposite way around. It's not that sentient beings have Buddha nature or that Buddha nature exists within sentient beings, but it's more that sentient beings exist within Buddha nature. So, and of course, first one thinks really, but I think it makes a lot of sense, because if you think about it, you know, if you understand Buddha nature as some little thing that sits somewhere in our body, you know, that's very limited. But Buddha nature is like, you know, infinite spaciousness. So how would that ever be possible to be located in a sentient being, which has clear spatial limitations? So to me, it makes a lot of sense to say, you know, it's like the sentient beings are like, and he uses that example, sentient beings are like clouds in the sky. So it's not that the sky, of course, also exists within the sentient being, but the sky is much bigger than the sentient being. And actually the sentient being is an obscuration of the sky. So once the cloud dissolves, then the sky is clearly present and not obscured. And by the way, that very same statement is actually also made by other people like Longtenpa, for example, several times in his text, the exact same thing. So it's not just the eighth Karmapa.
Indeed, yes. And a lot of these teachings, of course, in the Karmakaji tradition, on Buddha nature is linked to Mahamudra, as in other Kagyu traditions. And you have the ultimate continuum, Uttara Tantra, being identified as the text on Mahamudra, and particularly Sutra Mahamudra. Where does this term Sutra Mahamudra sort of originally, initially come from? And how is it explained vis-a-vis the ultimate continuum?
It seems that the term itself is really found the first time in Chaming Kongtrul's Treasury of Knowledge. And as I said before, if one would look like thoroughly through that other text I mentioned by the second Kama Trinlipa, one, who knows, maybe it's there too, but I haven't done that. But that's what we know. It seems not to be appearing before that. So Chaming Kongtrul makes this division into three types of Mahamudra: Sutra Mahamudra, Tantra Mahamudra, and Essence Mahamudra. And so he explains that quite clearly in the Mahamudra section of the Treasury of Knowledge. And he says Sutra Mahamudra in essence is Prajnaparamita. The name is Mahamudra, and it is in accord with mantra. So those are the three characteristics. And that is actually that something that's taken more or less from a commentary by Sahajavajra on Maitripa's Tattva Dashaka, 10 stanzas on true reality. So he says the same thing. Like he says, he equates Mahamudra and Prajnaparamita. And then also he talks about this being in accord with mantra, but he does not use the term Sutra Mahamudra as such, but definitely his text is often cited as a source for Sutra Mahamudra, because it talks about a path that is not linked to the four empowerments of the Nirutara Tantra Yogas, Nirutara Yoga Tantras, but it's outside of that, but it involves some Vajrayana elements. And the key two elements is Guru Yoga, Guru Devotion, and pointing out instructions. But the teachings itself in Sutra Mahamudra are based on the Sudrayana teachings, and that seems also to be what Gampopa then did, depending on the capacities of his students.
Well, quite a lot to ask you and learn from you also about authors after the Eighth Karmapa, but I think it's now time to see if the audience have questions and give the audience an opportunity to ask you. So let's turn to Marcus.
Okay, so yeah, there are a lot of different questions coming in. But maybe we could start at the beginning with a sort of overview question. Someone asks about the actual terms for Buddha nature, like Tathagatagarbha, and what their etymologies are and what it's all about. So maybe we could go back to that and just review briefly the terms for Buddha nature.
Well, would you like to take that?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you look at Tathagatagarbha, then there's two parts, Tathagata, and you can take that either to mean thus gone or gone to thusness. And so we all know that's an epithet for the Buddha, and Garbha in Sanskrit can both mean womb, but also that which is in the womb, or like the most holy sanctum of a temple, for example. So so when you take these two together, then the usual understanding is that it means, Tathagatagarbha means, a lot of people have translated it as actually like womb of the Tathagata, or embryo of the Tathagata, or germ of the Tathagata, something like that. But at least in Tibetan tradition, it's very clear that it refers to something that is within sentient beings, like the Buddha within, so to speak. And interestingly, and the Chinese translators seem to have gone the other way. They understand the Garbha term more as a kind of an enclosure. And that may be that this accounts for then in Chan tradition and also Zen, the position that Buddha nature is everywhere, even in inanimate things. But in Tibetan tradition, it's very clear it's not. And Indian tradition also doesn't say that. Like, it's only sentient beings where the Tathagatagarbha is in them.
And there are also other terms like gotra or rik, lineage, gene used, and also dhatu that I think Carl has shared earlier. Referring to element or sphere.
Right. So there's another question that I think we should get to right away, because I know Carl doesn't have a lot of time. He has another event just to do online, I think.
Only at 7, so.
Okay, good. So the title you gave for this talk was, "What is my mind without me?" Can you say more about that explicitly? What's that about?
Yeah, I'm still trying to find that out. but basically, I mean, that's, you know, you could say that's like the Buddha nature koan, right? If you find out what your mind is without you, that is Buddha nature. But what exactly that feels like, that's, you know, that's the research project here. And of course, you know, for the ordinary dualistic mind or the ego mind, it's not even imaginable what our mind would be without us, right? Like, it's very difficult because we always consider it as my mind. Like, that's completely ingrained. So if you just take away the my and just say mind, then there's kind of a big gap there, which is probably good. But I mean, it completely dissolves the usual relationship that we have to our mind, which we, I think, mostly consider as some kind of possession or something that we control, all those kinds of things. So if all of that falls away, like, what is mind on its own if we let it be without ego thoughts and stuff interfering?
Mm-hmm. And is that tied to the Kamapa's idea of the there being no sentient beings?
Yes, definitely.
I was actually wondering if you were trying to pass a bigger message through that title, to sort of say that Buddha nature is not really a greater self that the Buddhists generally deny.
Yes, that's a big point. Yes, definitely. So yeah, Buddha nature is not an upgrade of ego. It's actually the ultimate downgrade of ego.
There's a lot of other more complicated questions coming through here. Let's see. Well, one question is, can you explain the some sort of relationship between Parinirvana, Trisvabhava Nirdesha, and Buddha nature?
Wow, that sounds like a PhD topic. Well, I mean, first of all, Vasubandhu in his text, it is not about Buddha nature, right? It's about the three natures. So he doesn't explicitly talk about that. And of course, the connection between the three natures and Buddha nature is made by other people, and particularly in the Shantung tradition then. There are some Indian precursors who also do that, interestingly, in some commentaries on the Prajnaparamita Sutras. And there's some debate whether one of these is by Vasubandhu or not, which hasn't been ultimately resolved, where it is said that the Parinirvana is empty of both the Parikalpita and the Paratantra, which is usually not said in in classical Yogacara texts. That is said that the Paratantra being empty of the Parikalpita being the Parinirvana. So, but the real joining of Yogacara materials, three natures, and Buddha nature teachings, I think, in India only happened pretty late, like in some of the writings of Ratnakara Shanti, Gyanashri Mitra, and a few others. But the mainstream of that happening in a big way was the Shentong then, starting with Dalpopa. And of course, you could say that the third Kamapa was sort of in that stream too, but he didn't call it Shentong. But he clearly connected Buddha nature and the three natures in his writings.
So another person asked, you mentioned Dolpopa, so I'll ask this one. You mentioned Dolpopa's response to the idea that samsara and nirvana are differentiated by whether or not you recognize Buddha nature. What was Dolpopa's objection to that?
Well, he said that doesn't fly, that doesn't work, because in his view, samsara, nirvana, or relative and ultimate truth are completely separate. Like you said, they're like two different kingdoms. They have nothing to do with each other. So, which means it doesn't work if you recognize the one to get rid of the other, because they're completely disconnected. Something else has to happen. Like you actually have to go from the one to the other, so to speak.
Right. And that's quite different from the third Karmapa's presentation of this stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah. Like it's a question of recognition versus non-recognition. And in Dalpopa, he doesn't subscribe to mere recognition. He says there needs to be more than that. Like that's not what the path consists of.
And can I ask, how does someone like Kenpo Tsochim Gyamso Rinpoche in modern times teach about that?
Well, he definitely also taught a lot about recognition and non-recognition. So he definitely subscribed to that. I never heard him mention that samsara and nirvana or relative and ultimate reality are like two different kingdoms, only when you refer to Dalpopa. And actually, the Uttara Tantra was in his teaching career in the West. That was one of the first texts that he taught, I think, right after the dual ornament. Quite extensively, actually. And then, you know, and that many of those teachings are actually preserved in Rosie Fuchs' book, Buddha Nature, in the notes in the end. So there he clearly exposes a Shantong view. There's no doubt about that.
Right. But a Shantong view that might be slightly different from Dalpopa.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
Definitely more in line with third Karmapa or eighth Karmapa, as we discussed, like a more balanced view.
Right. And would you say that's common in the Kagyu tradition?
No, not really. Like you could say after Jamin Kongtrul, there was more of a polarization actually, because Jamin Kongtrul, as I said, mainly follows Taranatha.
Right.
And Jonang presentation of Buddha Nature Taranatha is not exactly the same as Dalpopa either, but still Jonang presentation of Buddha Nature is very much on the luminosity side and the quality side and all that, and is not favorable of Rangtong in that context. So, and I think mostly after Jamin Kongtrul, that's what people took as the Kachi view. But I think in more modern times that has been, you know, differentiated more by looking again more closely at the text by the Karmapas and things like that. And interestingly, when Jamin Kongtrul comments on the third Karmapa's writing, like his treatise on Buddha Nature, he does not go into any of the things that he says otherwise. He sticks very clearly to what the Karmapa says. Like he doesn't go into, you know, hardcore Shantong presentation of in the Jonang tradition there. So he definitely seems to have been aware of the difference.
Right. Interesting.
But then the whole Rangtong, Shantong, you know, I mean, there's many debates over many centuries. And then, of course, at some point, it also has become some almost like some corporate identity thing, you know, like two soccer fan clubs. Well, either you have to belong to this one or to that one. Like this is, so it was sometimes a little bit difficult to find a middle ground there.
Yeah. All right.
For example, also Trungpa Rinpoche, he also definitely teaches a non-exclusivist Shantong view.
Right.
In Kamakaji, yeah.
Right, right. there's more questions about Shintong, of course, many of them. One is a little bit more specific, but since we're on it, we could ask it. For Shentangpa, what is the object of meditation of a Bodhisattva Arya on the uninterrupted path of seeing, I think, is what they mean, and meditation? I'm not quite sure what that person is going for, but yeah.
Well, Buddha nature.
Yeah.
There's definitely, at that point, there's nothing else.
Nothing else but Buddha nature, yeah.
If you're meditating on anything else on the first bhumi, then you're not on the first bhumi.
Right. So maybe this next part is another part of that question. In terms of the union of emptiness and luminosity, is it that there should be no reification within that luminosity, or the realization that the luminosity is empty of inherent existence? Oh, that's bringing it back to the big question, I suppose.
Well, I think the big question here is whether those two options, what's the difference?
Yeah.
Like, what's the difference between not reifying and then not having or lacking real existence or intrinsic existence? To me, that sounds pretty much the same, unless there's some subtle point I'm missing. But in the view of the third Karmapa and the so-called non-exclusivist Shantong, they try to combine the Rangtong and Shantong view in that, yes, the nature of the mind is not understood as just plain emptiness, because then you have a hard time, what about the qualities, Buddha qualities? But at the same time, if any of these qualities are made into anything, then that's not it. So, but I think one of the big confusions or problems with this whole debate about Rangtong and Shantong is that when you look at Dalpopa, how he came about, how these terms came about in his writing, he actually was not treating them on the same level of discourse, which means Rangtong for him is a philosophical system that works with logic and is on the conceptual level. Mm. Whereas Shantong is mostly on the experiential level.
Mm.
It's not based on reasoning or, you know, nailing things down or something like that. So we're talking about two rather different things. Like, one thing is you talk about a philosophically defined whatever ultimate nature through inference and reasoning. That's still conceptual. And then you have the experience of what you have been talking about, but that's different. And then it's very hard to talk about the one with the terminology of the other. And I think that's one of the basic problems of this debate. Like, how can you talk about experience through logic? How can you refute experience through logic? It's very difficult. And from the Rangtong point of view, anything you say about your experience, once you say it, it can be refuted. So, but the actual experience, how are you going to refute that? That's very difficult.
But either in Rangtong or in Shentong, I mean, there would be philosophical expositions as well as sort of experiences in there. So I don't know if this is going to be a clarification to that last question, whether that person is actually talking about a slightly more nuanced understanding, as in reification applying to all extremes in the Madhyamika terminology. So not reifying it as emptiness or non-emptiness or existence and non-existence and so forth. And then lack of inherent existence being much more sort of aligned to what the Gelugpa interpretation of emptiness is, of only eliminating the intrinsic nature of things and not going beyond existence, non-existence, and so forth. So if that were the sort of doubt that the person who asked the question has, then I would say that in Rangjung Dorje's case, he argues for non-reification in all sense, isn't it? Neither existence nor non-existence and so forth. It's not only about eliminating an intrinsic existence, but all extremes or all sort of reification and conceptual fabrication.
Yes, definitely. And I think that that's also, I mean, of course, it's very hard to, you know, assess what the experience of a person is when they talk about these things. But that's why at least the non-exclusive Shantungs say that no matter which one of those two paths you're taking, you should arrive at the same result. So in other words, if you stripping the mind from all reification, you should arrive at the same experience as if you were doing meditation on a more Shantung based presentation, if you understand it correctly, because you cannot arrive to Shantung on a reified idea of Buddha nature or something like that. If you do, then you have not understood the Shantung presentation. So, but again, there's a lot of debate, but to me it makes sense if you combine, because the Rangtong view definitely is a kind of, you know, vaccination against thinking in whatever more or less subtle way of Buddha nature as being, you know, some super self or something, or reification. And then the presentations on luminosity and the qualities and that it's experiential, that is an antidote against just getting stuck in a conceptual refutational mode. So I think the two do go together if applied properly and skillfully.
Do we have more questions, Marcus, or should I?
Yeah, there are a few more questions, certainly. Let's see, does it seem that the issue of Buddha nature changing or not gets solved by the notion of a gotra which changes and develops so that Buddha nature doesn't have to change? That's the whole question. Does that make sense?
The question is about a gotra that's not Buddha nature?
I'm not sure exactly what they mean there. It would have to be somehow different.
Perhaps
giving different positions on Buddha nature or gotra being permanent or not will help clarify this doubt, you know? Because there are some philosophers who would say Buddha nature is just a seed that changes and can be cultivated, especially among the Gelugpas and the Sakyapas. And then there are others like Rangjung Dorje, Longchenpa, and Dolpopa who would probably say Buddha nature is fixed eternal entity that needs only revealing and not changes, right? Perhaps maybe that sort of explanation is what the person who asked the question wants.
Yeah, I think maybe it comes from the, you know, the two main gotras that are presented, which is, you know, the naturally abiding gotra and then the developing or expanding gotra. So the what is called the expanding or developing gotra that seems to change, because that's, but from the Buddha nature point of view, then the developing gotra is not really in substance different from the naturally abiding. It's just the process of the naturally abiding gotra being revealed gradually. So which means that there are not really two different ones. It's still the same Buddha nature, but the one is being obscured by the obscurations, and then when it becomes gradually free of those obscurations, it becomes revealed more and more. But in itself, it doesn't change, at least according to Uttarachandra and definitely the Shantung view.
Right. So that doesn't really get around some of the questions from other Tibetan masters or other lineages that would present it differently. That is to say, presenting those two types of gotra doesn't actually fix the philosophical problem.
No, not.
I think
not
the presentation of In some writings of some authors, like Gelsab J, for instance, I think they come up with this hermeneutics of two gotras in order to explain Uttara Tantra more conveniently. There's the ultimate gotra, which would be emptiness of inherent existence, and then the conventional gotra, which is really the sort of predisposition to become the Buddha, to seek enlightenment, that sort of more experiential or sort of cognitive mental state. So it looks like the two gotras that at least you see in some authors is used mainly as a tool to explain the presentation of Buddha nature in different sources.
Yeah, I think if you understand the two gotras as you just said, then that comes pretty close to what the person was asking, because when you take the natural abiding gotra as emptiness, that of course doesn't change. But then the other one, that can change.
Okay. Another question is about Kongtrul's view, Shentong, and the Kagyu lineage. So you mentioned that Zhangun Kongtrul's view on Buddha nature was influenced by Shentong view, especially by Taranatha. If I understood you right, can you please elaborate a bit more specifically if there's an influence on the current understanding in the Kagyu lineage?
Yeah, I think a lot of people still, if I understand the question correctly, I think a lot of people still in the Kagyu tradition are very strongly oriented towards the view of Zhangun Kongtrul based on the treasury of knowledge, because that's kind of, you know, like the Kamakagyu Bible, so to speak, since it came about. And but it needs to be clear that the treasury of knowledge is really pulling from different sources. There's also a lot of Shakya Chokden in there. There's a lot of Taranatha, Samdal Popa. There's, of course, a lot of Nyingma material also in there. And when one looks at the whole thing together, then it is not necessarily that everything always fits seamlessly together, because Zhangun Kongtrul pulls from different sources that don't necessarily always agree. However, the mainstream presentation of, I think, Kamakagyu of Shentong after him was mainly based on the treasury of knowledge. And I think these days it gets a little bit more differentiated, because people look into, you know, the texts of major Kamakagyu figures before Zhangun Kongtrul. And for example, also His Holiness Karmapa recently gave a lecture series on supposedly the 30 stanzas of Vasubandhu, but then he went basically the big picture of Yogacara, and also he talked about Shentong and Rangtong and Buddha nature and all those kinds of things. And yeah, so that was a very interesting presentation that was more based on like Dvad Karmapa, Eighth Karmapa, and others in that regard. And by the way, he said pretty clearly that the third Karmapa is a Shentongpa. So, you know, and if anybody, he should know.
There you go. That's great. Well, Karma, would you like to perhaps wrap up the session?
Yes, indeed. It's already 1 hour and 17 minutes. Oh, there's a lot more to ask. I actually wanted to ask about the role of Yogacara in the Karmakagyu teachings, and also a few other things, but maybe wrap up by asking you this question, which is more personal. So obviously Buddha nature study and practice must be shaping your own outlook and understanding of life. What can others, especially people coming from the similar background as yours, learn from it, and what can they do to sort of get more inspiration or get influence from Buddha Nature teachings?
Yeah, I think for me, Buddha Nature teachings are, you know, the best antidepressant. Like, even if you have a really bad day, then, you know, your Buddha Nature is still doing fine. And I think the more we can get that into our head and our heart and our mind, that alone, I think, makes a big, big difference. Because then whatever goes on in our mind, in our world, you know, however troublesome it may seem, there's still that place one can come back to as, you know, however you want to call it, the true home of the mind. And so I think that is something extremely valuable, and that's something that nobody can take away. And it's really a matter of reminding ourselves as much as we can, and then try to give it a chance and connect. Like they say, you know, give Buddha Nature a chance.
Indeed. Well, yes, let's hope people around the world will give Buddha Nature a chance. Thank you for that wonderful, concise final message. So with that, thank you everyone joining us from around the world, and thank you very, very much, Carl, for your wisdom, for sharing your knowledge. Thank you. And thank you, Marcus.
Thanks. Yes, thanks thank you all everybody. So much. Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.